David, can you hear me? Thuin? Okay, try him again. Sorry, we dropped him. Yes, fortunately, we don't have them on cell phones, so we don't have that kind of a dropped call problem. By the way, the imprint on Tim's book, though Penguin is the overarching publisher, Dutton is the, if you're looking by publisher, it's Dutton that has produced the hardback copies. And I'm not sure whether they have it in paperback yet. Do you, anybody? No, I think it's all in hardback right now. Yes, yeah, Sean. They have an audio, and does Tim read the audio? Tim, okay, they've got an audio version of the book with Tim reading it. Okay, mlj.org.uk is the Martin Lloyd-Jones Trust site that has those sermons. And it was interesting, just a year ago in talking with John Piper, when he is on his treadmill, he is listening to Martin Lloyd-Jones. That's what he's doing. He's listening to Lloyd-Jones preach, not just the evening messages, but the morning messages. That's just what John does on the treadmill. So it really is amazing that in our day and age you can sit under these ministries that you wouldn't have had access to years and years ago unless you had physically been at the location. I think we have Dr. Wells back on the line again. David, are you there?
I am, Lake.
Thank you so much for joining us at the Twin Lakes Fellowship via telephone. Are you on the campus at Gordon-Conwell today?
I am. I'm sitting here in my office, and I'm thinking about all of you at Twin Fellowship.
Listen, we so deeply appreciate you taking the time with us, and we remember your message to us and what a profound effect it had on us. And it's great to have you back talking about the courage to be Protestant. You don't happen to have your copy yet, do you?
I do not. It was scheduled to leave the warehouse on the 28th of this month. March.
And so you should perhaps any day now get your author's copy, and it'll begin to make its way into the bookstores and things like that very, very soon.
Should be happening right now.
David, when I first read the manuscript, it had a different subtitle than it has now. Would you tell the folks about the title of the book and the subtitle and why you gave the title and the subtitle of the book?
Yeah, well, thank you. And I wish that instead of looking at the blank wall of my office, I were actually down there and looking out on all of those good people who are gathered, many of whom are friends, and among whom I suspect are possibly even one or two graduates, students who pass through my courses, and amazing to tell, they actually survived. So I'm sure they're there to tell the tale. I'm sure they tell it in terms of miracles.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, this little project of mine started out as a simple summary of the four previous books which I had written, which some people told me were inaccessible and difficult to read, and still others didn't like footnotes in books. So what I set out to do was to write a friendly-looking book. Now, I won't say that this is Reader's Digest. I will only say it's about as close as I can get to Reader's Digest. And what I set out to do was simply to provide a summary. But what I quickly discovered was that it wasn't really possible to compress the 1,200 odd pages of the four previous books into about 200, or it actually turned out to be about 240, I think. So what I did was to reconceptualize. And in the process of doing that, a slightly sharper thesis emerged in my mind, which I then sought to capture in the subtitle, which, Leg, was the question that you asked me. So I still have your question in mind.
Thank you, David.
I may sound like a long-winded professor, but I have not forgotten what I was asked. So my five themes were truth, God, self, Christ, church. Certainly the first four of those themes are present quite a bit in my first four volumes. The fifth one, some of my good friends and a couple of my critics have said was not present in my books, that is, of the church. And I accepted that criticism as valid, and so I have actually added to what I have said in the books. Now, my thesis that I state in the opening sentences of the manuscript, the thesis is that in the West, it takes no courage to sign up to be a Protestant because millions are doing it without peril or cost. It does take courage to live by the truths that have been at the heart of Protestantism at its best, because these truths have to be affirmed and lived within a postmodern culture that is hostile to them. But not only that, they have to be affirmed and lived within the context of evangelicalism, where they often receive no more welcome than they do in the postmodern culture outside. So I then, in the opening chapter, and Leg, I have not forgotten your question.
This is pure gold, David. You just keep on going.
I'm circling around it. I'm now just about to answer it. What I do in the first chapter is to draw my map of the evangelical world. And what I've suggested is that the evangelical world today is breaking up into three constituencies. And these are the three constituencies that I have named in the subtitle of the book. The subtitle being Truth Lovers, Marketers, and Emergents. The first constituency is a reconstituted classical evangelicalism that was put together by people like Henry and Francis Schaeffer and Stott and Martin Lloyd-Jones in the years following World War II, with which the Reformed have had a kind of uneasy alliance, cooperating, working with, at other times feeling a bit of distance from, and in more recent years, increasingly feeling more distance from this kind of evangelicalism. But that's my first constituency. The second is the one that was born in the mid-1970s, associated in particular with Bill Hybels and that whole experiment of church marketing, which even as we speak is imploding. And the third constituency, which is actually in reaction to both of the first two, are the emergents. So what the question I have been asking is, where do the truths, the solas of the Reformation, How do we affirm those, and what has happened to them in our church world today, dividing as it is into these three constituencies and finding itself in the context of this postmodern and often nihilistic culture? So that's my long answer to your very simple short question, Nick.
It's a great answer to the question. Let me come back to each of these categories, because in, as you say, in that first chapter, The Lie of the Evangelical Land, you chart your map out. Tell us a little bit about the characteristics of each of these different three categories, and talk to us about the problems and the opportunities that are presented to us by understanding those characteristics.
Well, I think when you think about that kind of classical post-World War II evangelicalism that emerged, the defining thing about it was its focus on doctrine. I think many of us remember those internal debates. Are you a Baptistic? Are you a Peter Baptist? What do you think about tongues, women's ordination? What do you think about the millennium? You know, all of those questions that people discussed in animated ways and which defined groups within this constituency, they were all doctrinal issues. What happens in the 1970s is that the defining issue is no longer doctrine. The defining issue becomes culture and how you relate to it. How the marketers relate to culture and how the emergents relate to it, however, is a little bit different. The marketers, being marketers, were after success. They were asking, what do we need to understand about our consumer? What do we need to understand about people so that we can pitch to them successfully? In that sense, it strikes me that this whole enterprise that Bill Hybels started, and which now he himself has acknowledged has failed miserably, this whole enterprise, by its very nature, really was superficial. When you come to the emergents, you have something a little different, because they have seen the superficiality of this consumerist type believing. What they want is some more depth, something that is not so ephemeral. I am with them in that concern. I think that's a very legitimate concern, because when you trivialize Christian faith, you no longer have Christian faith left. A trivialized Christian faith is a faith that is deeply unfaithful to the greatness of God and His grace and the gospel and His word. So trivialize it and you lose it. So I share that critique, and it's one of the ironies of this situation that it is a number of these postmoderns who actually have liked the books that I have written for that reason. But on the other hand, my great difference with the postmoderns is their capitulation to a postmodern epistemology. They have basically surrendered at this point of truth. There is a crisis throughout the West about knowing and what we can know, and whether it is arrogant to believe in truth. And whether we should not be more modest and realistic and say that it is It is just truths that we have, and my perception, and be more humble in that respect. This is the line that Brian McLaren and Rob Bell and all of these people are pushing. And while nobody would despise modesty, one must say, however, that this is not an appropriate modesty. This is more unbelief, because it is refusing to accept the truth that God has given us in His Word. We have to believe that if God inspired His Word for the nurture and encouragement and instruction of the church, that that truth that He has given us in and by and through and with His Word is not inaccessible to us. We must believe that it is accessible. Otherwise, if I may say this reverently, God would have made a great mistake and would have acted very foolishly to think that we could have His truth when, in fact, being postmoderns, we cannot. So I see some very, very deep issues that are now dividing the evangelical world. And while it is always precarious and perhaps even unwise to make prophecies, I don't think that there you would be going out too far on a limb to say that what we are seeing in among the marketers with their deliberately non-theological approach to church doing, and in the emergents who, for a somewhat different reason, do not want to use the language of truth. What we are seeing in both cases is the soil within which the new liberalism is going to come.
Mm. David, in the first four volumes, some of the critics complained that you spent a lot of time describing and critiquing, but not prescribing and offering solutions. And so, however unfair the criticism may be, I do know that in this volume you have tried to point us the way forward in these areas. Would you talk just a little bit about each of these key categories of truth, God, self, Christ, church, and tell us a little bit about where you see the way forward for us in our current cultural moment?
Well, I do plead guilty to that critique that has been made of me, sometimes by those who are unfriendly and sometimes by those who are friendly to me. And I have to say that I think I made a miscalculation. When I started out writing these books, I assumed that the problem was that people just didn't understand how the culture was impinging on their believing and behaving. Because all of us have difficulty with that. I have difficulty with that. When you are immersed in a culture, you don't always understand how it affects your attitudes and what you place values on and so forth. So I thought that if I could just shine a light on this, people would say, "Ah, of course, now I understand." But actually, I think the disintegration of the church had gone a little bit further than I realized. So it's a little bit more like a child who's been brought up in a highly dysfunctional family and perhaps has not had a father or mother, who then gets married and then begins to ask him or herself, "Gee, I wonder what a Christian family would look like if it really did function and you really did have a father and a mother there, and how would the children relate to the father and mother?" So I have an idea that is what has happened in the evangelical world, and I must admit, I think I miscalculated on that point. So, what I'm going to do, as you know, Lig, I have written this final volume. It's a summary with these five core central themes. And we're going to try to put this into a DVD series for churches with study guides and a leader's guide and a geared down set of materials to try to get some more leverage for this. Leverage, perhaps you would say. I can't remember the difference between English and American now. Whatever it is. The five themes are truth, a lost guide, God, a lost center, self, a lost soul, Christ, a lost savior, church, a lost sanctuary. And what we want to try to do is first to try to explain how the concept, if I can just take this first one, how the idea of truth was lost. And the important point about this is not that it is simply an idea, but it is the objective world, the existence of an objective world which we can know. And following this, and a God who is outside of us whom we can know. These are the things that are lost. So, and in their place, we have to substitute subjective opinion and feelings and so forth. So what we want to try to do is to turn this around, first look at the analysis, and then talk to ourselves about how in the churches we can encourage each other to begin to think in terms of truth, to nurture truth from the scriptures in ourselves and so forth. And we will work through all five themes in this kind of way.
David, this video project is, you've got a pretty impressive videographer working with you, a team from the West Coast. You want to tell the guys about that a little bit? You and I have been working together on this, and we've had great help from another of your students, John Seal, who worked with Oz Guinness on the book No God But God a number of years ago. And tell us just a little bit about who we're working with on this and when you hope to roll this out.
Well, we are just on the very verge of launching this. It's all new to me, so I'm just an author. I just know about sitting in front of my computer and writing a manuscript and putting it in the mail and sending it to a publisher. And this is all new territory to me. But I'm very excited about it because we have to think of the next generation. And we have to think about how this transmission of the ideas that have been at the heart of Protestantism at its best, which are themselves the ideas that come out of Scripture and that the Reformers rediscovered and reformulated. It's this line of believing that is anchored and in the Bible and defined by it that we have a responsibility to make sure gets to the next generation. So I want to go beyond this relatively small circle of readers who are willing to struggle and puzzle and sweat their way through my dreadful pages of my books. and there is no question that if we can do this successfully, through this medium of film, almost in a Socratic fashion, raising questions and leading people into a consideration of these issues, we will have done very well. The filmmakers we're working with, I don't know if I can mention a name because we haven't quite finalized the contract with them, but I will say that they have made an award-winning movie, and Lig and I watched a PBS documentary that was very, very fine, which they had done, and they're currently, I was with them a week or two ago, they're currently doing another PBS documentary on salmon. So they don't care who they point their cameras at. They point them at salmon, they point them at me. I hope I'm better looking than the salmon that they're going to be filming. But what we want to do is, for example, the first one on truth, we will actually film in Harvard, in Harvard Square in Cambridge, and we will take locations that are provide the appropriate background for what we are doing. And our hope is that we will have all of this completed in time for the Lausanne World Gathering in Cape Town in October of 2010. See, the issues that we are facing here in the West, which I believe have played such a large hand in the weakening of historic Protestant believing, these issues are not peculiar to the West. When I travel to Africa, and where I travel every year, and also I've traveled less so, but when I have been in Asia, pastors and leaders there have told me exactly the same thing. Indeed, my books, these last four books, have been translated into Chinese and Korean and, of all things, Indonesian. And I have had correspondence from people reading those books, and they say the things that you're describing about America are exactly what we're seeing in our own countries and in our own churches. So we can do a favor to the worldwide church, in part by telling them some of the things that we have learned about our engagement with a modernized culture. And some of the things we have learned, I believe, are how not to engage it. And if you're thinking of my three constituencies, the marketers would be an illustration of how not to engage a modernized culture with its preoccupation with consumption, and the emergence would be another example of how not to engage a modernized culture with its postmodern mood.
David, thank you so much for spending this time with us this morning and for producing this book. This will be published by Erdmann's?
It will be published by Erdmann's, and it should be in bookstores within days.
Yes, I'm hoping that perhaps at Together for the Gospel we'll have copies to make available to the folks there in just a couple of weeks. So be on the lookout for The Courage to be Protestant, Truth Lovers, Marketers, and Emergents in the Postmodern World by David F. Wells. David, thank you so much for being with us. The Lord bless you.
Thank you. It's my privilege and just great to talk to you folks.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.